about 15 or maybe 20 years ago, probably closer to 15, there started to be a very popular genre of books that people were buying and reading with great frequency. One of the first was something called Freakonomics. It was a book about economics, not economics in the monetary sense, but economics about the books about efficiencies and the way we lead our lives and the reasons we make decisions and why things go on the way they go on and what's the real story behind a lot of everyday occurrences and everyday decisions. Malcolm Gladwell got into the act. He's probably the most popular author of this entire type of genre, The Tipping Point and Blink. These are all very good books that describe to us the way we think and why the things around us that are happening to us are really happening the way that they are. So as you might imagine what happened, it did happen. There were a couple of sports writers for Sports Illustrated. One of them, the lead one, was a guy named L. John Wertheim. He's a very accomplished writer for Sports Illustrated. He's written some phenomenal articles and a series of other great books. So he and a couple of his colleagues decided to write one about sports. I was incredibly, incredibly excited to read this book. It was going to be a book about hardcore analytics, about everything that goes on in a basketball arena, everything that goes on in a baseball stadium. Why do the things that we are watching inside these stadiums and in these games, why are they really happening the way that they are happening? And it was a little bit of a letdown. It wasn't the greatest book that I ever read. I didn't like too much. But the most famous chapter that they had, just to give you a taste of what this book was about, the most famous chapter they had is that anybody who's ever even casually followed professional sports knows, or even high school sports playing them, knows that there's something called the home field advantage. Problem is that people who think about these things do not know exactly what or why a home field advantage works. What is a home field advantage? Why do teams play better at home than on the road? There are a number of theories. If I asked people right now to write down the first thing that came to their mind, we'd probably come up with 6 or 7 different ideas that 20 or 25 people would have in their minds right away. The quality of sleeping in your own bed at night, having a home-cooked meal instead of being in a hotel, good sleep. Knowing the ins and outs of your particular arena in baseball, that's a big deal. Let's get used to playing with the green monster or the little bit of the incline in center field for the Astros. Little things and quirks in the stadium, maybe that's what it is. Anybody know what their conclusion was, what home field advantage was really based on? The crowd, of course, is a big one, but anybody who's played a lot of sports or watched a lot of sports knows that that's not always true. Sometimes the crowd can hype you up too much and create pressure. There are a lot of great athletes who say that they love playing on the road, and there's nothing better than hitting a big shot and quieting the crowd when the crowd is going absolutely crazy. I don't know anybody know what they concluded their answer was. They did tremendous studies. They started to take out the variables. What if you had a home team without any quirks in their stadium? What happens if the Boston Red Sox are the home team and they're playing? It doesn't happen in baseball very often, but it does happen in college basketball, for example. What if you had all the fans but not your own stadium? What if you had your own stadium but not all the fans? They started to take out all the variables and figure it out. And again, we don't really have time for a long digression into this. They concluded actually there was referee bias. I don't want to get in trouble with Seth Markowitz or Morty Hoppentot and talk about referee bias in too much detail over here, but they concluded that's really what it was. LeBron James may not be affected by the crowd, but they discovered that the referees certainly are. Home teams get more calls because you may want to be a player and silence the crowd, but no referee wants to make that big exuberant call in front of 18,000 rabid fans and make them crazy. Okay, that was their conclusion, and I had to like take it or leave it. If I wrote such a book, there would be one chapter that I'd be excited about writing. One piece of sports analysis that I think is incredibly valuable to a great number of areas of our life, and I think it is relevant to this entire Lelion, to everything that we've been speaking about over the course of the past couple of hours tonight, everything we've been trying to think about and to learn about, and specifically, I think it has great application to our topic here tonight about bettering ourselves in the way that we daven, the way that we pray, in improving our tefillah, and making ourselves just better mispalalim, better people when it comes to the area of daven. The question that I would ask, and the one that I would have analyzed in the world of sports, is why is it that one of the most prevalent statistics that really goes through all sports, at least the ones unlike football, that play best of 7 series, so that would be baseball, hockey, basketball, not soccer, not football. Why do those sports have such a dominant edge when it comes to being up 3-0 in the series? We know that depending on the sport, it's either 99% of the time or 100% of the time. How many times in history does it happen that a team that is down 3-0 comes back to win the series? Not very often. We don't have to go through the numbers right now. I'm going to suggest to you, and play along with me for a minute, that most people have a mistaken impression for why that is. Most people do not have the right answer, and I am fairly certain that I'm going to suggest to you what the right answer is. People get seduced by words like momentum. People get seduced by all sorts of psychological impacts of confidence. If I'm down 3-0, I no longer believe in myself. It's really, really hard. People can think about it on a much more practical level. Maybe it's just the fact that against world-class playoff caliber competition, it's really hard to win 4 games in a row. How many times are the Los Angeles Dodgers over the course of an entire year going to have a 4-game winning streak? It'll happen. It's not an everyday occurrence. It's hard to sweep a doubleheader. It's hard to win 4 games in a row, especially against what Ben's playoff-level competition. These are the theories that people will usually give. One of those three. Momentum, whatever that means. Lack of confidence when you're down 3-0. Lack of belief in yourself and you just start having a loser's mentality instead of really walking onto the field and thinking you're going to win. And the very, very practical and real challenge and difficulty of winning 4 games in a row. What could be wrong with any of those theories? Or put differently, what could be better than any of those theories? What's a better suggestion, what's a better insight as to why teams have such a hard time winning when they're down 3-0? When I tell it to you, you will nod your head in agreement. And you will wonder why you are not thinking of it right now and why you don't have the answer readily for us at this very moment. The real reason why teams don't come back from winning when they are down 3-0 is because there is a reason why they are down 3-0 to begin with. 3-0 is a significant sample size. 3 games matter and it tells you something about which team is better and why they are in that situation in the first place. And for some reason, we neglect that level of insight. For some reason, we pretend like something is going to happen when there is no good reason for it to happen in the first place. I don't know much about how a meat grinder works. They don't make a lot of transparent meat grinders. There's an old saying that people like to eat hot dogs or sausages, but nobody likes to know how a sausage is made. There's a lot of nasty stuff that's going on there with blades and rotors and things spinning around. And we don't really understand. You take a big chunk of meat, you stick it into a meat grinder, and a hot hamburger comes out or a sausage comes out on the other side, and everyone can be happy. And we don't know the gory details of what's going on inside that machine. But here's what I do know. Speaking of prayer, which we'll get to right now, and speaking of the way that we daven, I don't know if you could possibly put lousy meat into a meat grinder and expect to come out with something different than what you put into it in the first place. I don't know if there's any way or any prayer that would work that would transform a horrendous product, would transform something that is essentially dog food, and you put it into this secret machine in this closed device, and you start grinding it up or pressing a button, and you expect that coming out to your hand is going to be the most incredible delicacy you've ever had in your life. If you enter into a series down 3-0, you're going to lose game 4. And if you get lucky in game 4, you're going to lose game 5. Because there's a reason why you lost the first 3 games to begin with. I'll say something which I hope is not misunderstood, and it's not really relevant for everybody in this room right now. But I get asked very often, and I have some rather strong opinions, about whether or not a person, a good, committed, Orthodox Jew, has a great chance of success or even religious survival on a secular college campus. We have a lot of outstanding madrichim who are excelling in the colleges that they go to that are not Yeshiva University and Lander's College. I'd be the last person to say that it's impossible to be a great Jew on a secular college campus. But what I will tell you is that the first question you have to ask yourself is why are you going to that campus in the first place? You can't expect the input into the decision, into the life decision that you're making, to be something that is mediocre or half committed. You can't expect to have any experience whether it is in the campus of Maryland or NYU, whether it's on NCSY Kollel or Camp Morasha, whether it's in our high schools or in our shuls, in our youth meeting or the places where we daven. You can't expect to have any experience with mediocre input, with an expectation of mediocrity or worse than mediocrity, and end up with something of incredible value and meaning. Life does not work that way. There is no scenario whereby that's going to be the case. And if a person is at all serious about being more than entertained by a shiur at night, or passing the time on a Tuesday evening on NCSY Kollel in a meaningful way, if a person were to be at all serious about really davening better, or really doing any of the things that we've been speaking about tonight in a better way, the first step is to pay attention and to try to change the input. To try to change and say, okay, this is what I want to do. I'm going to try to daven better. I'm going to be serious about changing the formula and changing the input of what I am doing in order to get a result that is going to be different. If we do not make an attempt in the first place, if we do not devote the time that we're devoting right now, if we do not change the variables and change the equation, if we do not approach the davening that we are doing in a way that says, let me try to make this better, let me try to do it differently, let me try to work on something that could be ideal or could be great, we are unlikely to have results that are going to shock us or surprise us. We're going to get exactly what we started with, and we're going to get something that is a perfect and exact reflection of what we put in and what we tried to do. If we try to daven better, we have a shot of being successful. If we think about what davening better would look like, even if our conclusions are philosophically off by a measure or degree or two, we'll still be able to emerge with a better davening than we would if we are aligned perfectly, but essentially couldn't care less. If we're not motivated, if we're not committed to davening in a proper way, to changing those input variables, to doing in a way that matters and doing in a way that's better, we're not going to be successful. There's a reason why teams fall down 3-0. And we could test the theory. If the Lakers with LeBron now, if the Lakers didn't have LeBron in those first three games, so how many teams that didn't have LeBron in the first three games and then get LeBron for game four, how many of those teams come back to win four straight? It's not going to be 1 out of 1,000. It's not going to be 3%. It's going to be a regular occurrence because the input has changed. The variables have changed. It's not the same status quo of a mediocre effort. It's a commitment, and it's a variable that is something different and something which allows for the type of success that we are looking for. So it's important not just to listen to whatever suggestions we make or to consider them or adopt any practices that I'll suggest over the next couple of minutes. It's important to think about what would a better davening for me look like and try to enact those changes, change those variables, to care about it enough to be committed to doing something differently and in a different way than we've done it up until now. At its heart, tefillah is a reflective, contemplative experience. If we don't think about what we are doing before we do it, as we do it, what we refer to generally as some form of kavana or intent that we have when we pray, if we don't take full advantage to reflect on what we are doing as we pray and as we daven, we'll almost certainly be missing the mark. And I want to talk about that on all three of the levels that I just described. First and foremost, in terms of time before we daven. Then secondly, the type of contemplations that will help us when we daven, the type of things we might want to think about as we're actually going through davening. And then we'll try to end up with a sort of overview about what a model of proper prayer can look like that can be better for us starting this evening, starting right away when we daven Maariv in just a few minutes from now. All three of those are applicable then. There is a famous Mishnah at the beginning of the fifth parak of Maseches Brachos. The Mishnah describes Chassidim Rishonim, the early righteous people, Chassidim Rishonim, who would wait, many of you are familiar of this Mishnah, who would wait an hour before they prayed. they would contemplate and think about what they are going to do. It talks about the time that it would take them to pray and the way they would have a post-game show and a wind down from davening as well. They would spend a lot of time in prayer. But the Mishnah highlights specifically the fact that they would take an hour before they daven, at the start of their prayer, before they actually began to pray, before they actually began to daven, they would take an hour to think about it. Now I want to learn with you something very simple about the Hebrew language. The word chassid, especially in modern sociological studies, Rabbi Gorman, no offense, it's not going to be nasty here, it's all going to be good and love, but the word chassid has a lot of misunderstood applications. Most people in this room would have a hard time giving a proper definition of the word chassid. If we were playing a word association game, the first thing that anybody here thinks of when I say chassid is somebody with long peyus, somebody who has a certain way of serving God, a certain mode of dress. Chassidim, as we call them, a certain sect of Judaism that have particular practices and styles in their dress and in their language, in their culture and in their community. Chassidim. Those are clearly not the chassidim that the Mishnah and the fifth parak of Brachos are referring to. That does not make any sense on a timeline. The Hasidic movement started a millennium and a half after the Mishnah was written. There were no Hasidim, the likes of which that we associate Hasidim with, in the time of the Mishnah. The Mishnah refers to these people that were Hasidim, the Hasidim Rishonim, the early Hasidim, but they're not speaking about our Hasidim. That much is clear. So I actually did the heavy lifting for everybody. I did the second most popular guess that people would have, so you don't have to say it. Most of us would translate the Hasidim Rishonim as those who were righteous. A chesed, a chassid would be the early, I don't know, good people, or the early special people, or the early righteous people. But something should be triggering in our mind. A tzaddik said that justice is really the definition for righteous. Chassid and righteous have no etymological connection. The words are really not the same at all. So what is a chassid? Well, we know there's something connected to the word chassid that's called chesed. So maybe it means the early good people. But that also doesn't make any sense. What would a person who gives a lot of tzedakah, what would a person who is kind and generous have to do with spending an hour before davening? That seems to be completely out of place. Just play along with that sentence. The early righteous people, it's not what it means. The early chassidim, in the sense that we do it, that's an anachronism. The early good people and generous and kind people, why would that have anything to do with the way people daven? Well, it's a simple mistake that many, many people make. The word chassid, as used in the Gemara, has one very, very specific translation. That translation in Hebrew is called lefnim mishuras hadin. It means people who go above and beyond. The reason why we call chesed chesed is not because the word chesed fundamentally means kindness. It means the definition of an act of kindness is an act that I do not have to do. If there's an act that I have to do, it is by definition not chesed. That's why, no offense to the school principals who are here, mandatory chesed hours, every educator knows, may be a necessary evil, but they are a little bit of a contradiction. If I have to do it, it's no longer a chesed. I've learned many great lessons of life from my father-in-law. One of my favorite lessons of life that I learned from my father-in-law is that my father-in-law, under certain circumstances, likes, especially with people with whom he's particularly close, he likes to pay two shiva calls. Because the first shiva call that he pays is the social obligation one. People in a circle of influence, a circle of friends, that somebody passed away, so you're obligated to pay a shiva call. But then as soon as you add the word obligated, it ceases to be a chesed. So therefore, he'll go a few days later, the friend will think he's senile. You do know you were here already. I know I was here already. The first time I was here because I had to be. The second time I'm here because that's a true chesed. I no longer have to be here anymore, and that's a chesed that I'm now unable to perform. The definition of all chesed and the definition of all chassid are people who go above and beyond what is required of them. They do more than the letter of the law. That's why acts of kindness and charity are often called chesed. And that's why these people in the Mishnah, that's their definition. The ones who did more than they have to do. You don't have to spend an hour before davening, but if you do, you'll be called a chassid. Doesn't make you a good person or a nice person. It doesn't even make you righteous. It just means you do more than the letter of the law requires. The great Rav Shlomo Volbe, one of the giants of Mussar, of I guess you'd call it the previous generation, passed away about 15 years ago. Rav Volbe asked an extraordinarily simple question on this Mishnah. What did they do that made them into Hasidim? The whole world thinks that they were Hasidim, above and beyond, extra steps, because they spent an hour before they davened. They spent time before they davened, excuse me. Said Rav Volbe, that's not correct. If you spend an hour before davening, you are a chassid. But if you spend no time before your davening, that doesn't make you a regular person. That's not what the din is. If you spend no time before your davening thinking about what you are going to do, thinking about what you're about to take part in, then there's no way that you're going to daven successfully. The baseline is not zero. The baseline is a reasonable or small amount of time that is absolutely required in order to daven in a better way. And it is remarkable how few people actually do this. I challenge every person in the room with what I call the 18-second test. There is nobody in this room who doesn't have 18 seconds a day to spare to work on his davening, to try to make it a little bit better. We daven three times a day. If you took 6 seconds, you can count them off right now. I'll do it on my watch for you. That was 6 seconds. Three times a day before Shacharis, Mincha, and Maariv, before we do anything, take 6 seconds, time them, just to set a mind and to think about what we are going to do. And see whether that makes a difference in any of the prayers that follow it. We put ourselves at an enormous, enormous disadvantage when we just run into davening the way that we do it. He used to joke all the time that Rebbeim used to go over to students and they used to mumble words to them a mile a minute. Just say it like that. Did you get it? Did you understand it? And the person would say, no, of course, I don't know what you're talking about. I couldn't follow it at all. And the smart Rebbe would say, aha, then how come you speak to God in the same way? I never fully understood the analogy because I think God's capacity to understand what we're saying greatly surpasses any of ours. But I understood the point they were trying to make. But I think there's a better type of analogy that we can make. There is nothing that we care about or want to do well that we would run into in the same way that we run into davening all of the time, without a moment of thinking and reflection. A big part when we daven mincha, which notably is in the middle of our day, without the type of lead-up or build-up naturally that we would otherwise have, a big part of the reason why we say ashrei before mincha is based on halacha that says when we say the words yoshvei beisecha, those who sit in your God in God's house, we should sit down for a minute. We should take a load off and just sit and contemplate for a second what we are doing before we start to daven. That's what's being asked of us when we say Ashrei Yoshvei Beisecha. You'll permit me another sports analogy because it's such an obvious one and everybody here is aware of it. You may be the biggest believer in practice or the rest of it, but no one would ever look kindly upon a player. I'm not even talking about the Super Bowl. For a preseason game, could you imagine the starting quarterback for an NFL team for a lousy, insignificant preseason football game who showed up in a sports car moments before kickoff, who ran into the locker room, ripped off his clothes, put on a jersey, you know, still tying up his shoes as he makes it out to the field, and just bursts onto the field without any moments of, okay, what am I about to do? It's indispensable, says Rav Volbe. A chassid does it for an hour. A normal person does it for a minute. A normal person does it at all. And a person who wants to be mired in mediocre prayer, he says, well, okay, I don't think that's really necessary. We will not have advanced, productive prayer experiences if we continue to ignore the meditative qualities of what we're supposed to do when we daven. To think about before whom we're about to speak. Why are we speaking to him? What is it that we hope to say, and what is it that we hope to accomplish when we dive into Hashem? One of the practical tips of how to transform tefillah into a more contemplative experience, I think, has a lot to do with the pacing of the way that we daven. And I'll say this next point very quickly, but I think it's an important one. Number one, sometimes I do believe we daven actually too slowly. When we're not in line with the chazan, or not in line with the minyan that we're davening in, it could be very, very difficult to maintain focus. There are a few things, and it's important to find a minyan that is at the pace at which you can daven, and there's a rhythm to davening that matters a great deal also. But there are many, many times where we daven way too quickly. A great way to daven is to take parts of davening and to say them exceedingly slowly with careful contemplation about the significance of each of those words that we are saying. Find the parts of davening that speak to us in the greatest way and put us in the frame of mind to communicate something of meaning to the God before whom we stand. That is much easier than it sounds like to be able to do. A couple of examples of how that works, and there's a cost to be paid. We're part of a minyan that's going to finish one way or another 35 minutes after it starts. But not every one of those minutes has to be equal. There are 19 brachos of Shmona Esrei, as we heard during the beautiful TJJ Ambassador Siyum today. Not every one of those 19 brachos, also in Rosh Hashanah Halacha Shir yesterday, coincidentally, not every one of those 19 brachos needs to be said at the same pace. If we find words that we find to speak to us, that reflect some of the emotions that we feel about and the types of things we want to say when we daven, it helps greatly. Modin is an amazing, amazing place to start with that. If a person were to read the words carefully and slowly, of Modin Anachnu Lach, refer to the miracles that are with us each and every day and moment of our lives, Erev, Boker, Vitzarayim, the miracles that accompany me, the good fortune that accompany me, we could transform tefillah into such an amazing, amazing, valuable experience in our lives. And we are not obligated to run through modim just as quickly as we run through everything else. There are ways to elevate the tefillos that we have and to turn it into something that we are thinking about in a genuine basis. I'll share with you a trick that I like to use from time to time, specifically when I'm reciting modim. I marvel, as I'm sure all of you do as well, whenever I think about the absolute miracle of our five senses. Everything we do when we interact with this world, we take it for granted way too often. We become so much better people when we don't. When we simply appreciate those living miracles that are around us all of the time, and I enumerate those five as a big part of those living miracles. And especially when I have a conversation with Rabbi Levi Greenspan, or especially when I interact with a person who is deprived of one of those five senses, or when I have a problem with my own eyes, thank God, not resulting in complete blindness or anything else like that. But even when you're driving in the hills and, you know, the ears are a little bit clogged, and we realize, wait a second, it's crazy that these awkward things allow me to hear things all of the time. Sometimes in those minutes of saying modim, I will try to utilize all five senses. Sometimes I'll just press my fingers against each other to marvel at, just think about for a few seconds a day. It's a different version of the 18-second test. It's not going to make you late for work. It's not going to make you miss your bus for school. We're davening anyway. Take a minute and say, it's pretty crazy that I can detect the tiniest of gradations on a table over here just sitting in front of me when I daven. Just to take a moment, it's such an incredible enhancer of tefillah, to listen to the Beis Medrash. Do it right now in this room. The little things, the hum of an air conditioner, or the clearing of a throat of a friend, the scraping of a chair. I mean, the world is a crazy place. This thing over here is allowing me to pick up on those things. And it doesn't make me any worse of a person if three times a day for a few seconds I contemplate and I think about it. Touch fingers to the lip for the sense of taste.
smell the environment around us and marvel. Look around and see the plethora of colors. How many times do we think about just appreciate a beautiful world? There are a lot of different color shirts in this room right now. We have an amazing, amazing array of visual stimuli that are here. And how lucky are we to be able to appreciate it? And how often do we think about it in the first place? There are so many parts of davening that we could do that for. There are parts of davening that are challenging. There are parts of davening that we don't all fully understand all the time. But with the tiniest of efforts, we can transform entirely dry paragraphs of tefillah into the most incredible parts of our prayer experience, of our entire religious experience. Another trick that's in the same vein that works also, and you're allowed to do it, is to take all 19 brachos of Shmona Esrei, all elements of Shacharis, Mincha, and Maariv, and tie it into the issue that you think about most. How easily can I make all 19 brachos have to do with the next day and a half on NCSY Kola? How easy is it for me to take all 19 brachos of Shmona Esrei and relate them to a particular life challenge that I am facing right now? That's not a corruption of tefillah. That's making tefillah real and meaningful and taking the time and the moments to be able to do it. There are ways in which we can slow down and say things that matter and make sure that we utilize the text of the Siddur, make sure that we spend the time to think about what we are saying, to transform tefillah into this contemplative experience, and to make it into something meaningful. It doesn't have to be only somebody else's words. It doesn't have to be only empty and meaningless. It can be, and can relatively easily be, as long as we want it to be, something more. And finally, I want to address what is one of, I think, the greatest myths when it comes to prayer, why we daven and how we daven. We have taken for granted throughout the last few minutes the notion that when I am standing in front of, when I am standing to daven, I am in fact cognizant of the fact that I am talking to God and standing in front of God. But that's not an easy proposition. And we would be lying to ourselves if we pretended that in Maariv, after Tversky wraps up this Leliyun, that when we go to Daven Maariv, all of us are going to sense the fact that we are standing in front of God. If we don't sense that, does that mean we shouldn't daven? Does that mean that our tefillah is relegated to something inconsequential, relegated to something mediocre, relegated to something that will not be successful? I'm going to suggest to you in our closing moments that that is quite the opposite of the truth. That it is fully possible and in fact obligatory for us, perhaps the essence of what real prayer is supposed to be able to stand before God and to use those contemplative skills, those meditative skills, to try to answer the question, before whom am I standing right now? The way I like to describe it is the fact that in shuls across the world, maybe in yours as well, there's a words that go in front of a shul, in front of a minyan, that say, Dalof ne miata omei. Know before whom you are standing. K-N-O-W, know. Try to be aware of who you are standing in front of. And we often view those words as a prerequisite for davening. That's why somebody will snap their fingers and say, get that gum out of your mouth. Or take that hat, that baseball cap, off of your head. Stop slouching. Get up out of your chair. Do you know before whom you are standing? But I don't think that's the main application of Dalof Ne Miata Omeid. I think Dalof Ne Miata Omeid has a question mark after it. I think Dalof Ne Miata Omeid is not rhetorical. I think Dalof Ne Miata Omeid is a real sense of wonderment that all of us have. Do we know before whom we are standing? Tefillah, when done properly, gives us a chance to find out what that answer may be. There's a beautiful idea that I saw not long ago that has had tremendous impact on my own personal prayer. We know that the first bracha of Shmona Esrei, a bracha that we're going to recite together in just a few minutes, is what we call the bracha of Avos. And the bracha of Avos, in which we refer to Jewish history, and the great example that was set by Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, ends with the words, Magin Avraham. We praise and bless God, who is the defender of Avraham, the shield of Abraham. It's a very strange way to refer to God. In what way is God the shield of Abraham? And why on earth do we begin davening with those words, Magen Avraham? After all, if anything, we were speaking about Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. Why single out Avraham? And frankly, why single out any individuals? If we're talking about Jewish history, talk about Jewish history. Where do we get this shield of Abraham from? And the answer that has been suggested is that Avraham had a very unique relationship with davening. Because Avraham was one of the first philosophers. He was a very, very kind man. But above all, Avraham was the one who stood in front of the world and stood in front of God and figured out before whom he was standing. Avraham discovered God through prayer. He didn't pray because he discovered God. He discovered God through the prayers that he did. He stood as an individual in front of a God that he could not have been certain of. He could not have been completely confident before whom he was standing. But he wondered and he speculated, might I be standing in front of the Almighty God? He tried to discover God through the words he was saying and the prayers he was uttering. That is an amazing, amazing, amazing model for all of us when we daven all of the time. Tefillah is not the result of complete belief and conviction in God's existence. Tefillah is something that we can do and take time out of our day and say, can we look a little bit closer? Those 18 seconds of preparation before davening, those moments of contemplation, of marvel and of awe about the beauty and the gifts around us when we say Moses. Every moment when we get in there with a group of friends and with an amazing community like what we have here and like we have the benefit to daven with over these 6 weeks, we get together and say, let's get to work. Let's look around us a little bit and see what we're going to discover. Let's find God in our base medrash. Let's find God in our tefillah. Let's find God in our lives through the davening that we do. It is a mission of discovery. It is an exercise in contemplation. It requires and demands of us thought about the things that are most important in our lives. And who amongst us doesn't need those moments for exactly that? To think about the beautiful words of David HaMelech. To evaluate what matters most in our lives and the things that we ask for as dictated by the great rabbis and sages of Jewish history. To think a little bit about the world around us, where we fit into it, and where we can discover God within those worlds also. So as we started, if a person is resigned to mediocre prayer, if a person is resigned to being the same son as Rav Schechter spoke about, or the same internet user as Rabbi Leibowitz spoke about, or the same student in high school as so many of the panels spoke about, and they're not willing to change the input, to commit to growth and to being better, you can forget about the whole thing. If we're just going to daven and go through the motions and expect somehow, some way, a brand new result or a different world, we're going to be very, very sorely disappointed. But if we are ready to transform the way we connect to tefillah, which is ultimately the way we connect to God, and ultimately the way we define ourselves religiously and personally, the way in which we think of who we are and what we believe and what we do, then we invest in churning tefillah into this type of thoughtful practice, into this contemplative exercise. And we think about what we are doing before we do it. And we think about the world around us as we say the words. And above all, through both of those things, we seek out meaning in our lives through the prayer that we do 3 times a day. With a drop of commitment, with 18 seconds a day, with a little bit of effort, we can be radically different daveners and radically different Jews. And we can have such meaning and value, such productivity in the types of things that we spend so much time doing anyway. We're going to head now to the Beis Medrash to hear Rav Twersky wrap up this Leil Miyun. And then we'll be able to put into practice together a little bit of meaningful contemplative tefillah in the hours that we'll have together.